I was going to get to interview Steve Jobs. You know, you're kind of daydreaming, like, maybe we'll really hit it off and I'll get his card, you know, I'll be able to follow up with him and get exclusive access to things. But no, the interview was a complete meltdown. Every single question I asked, his answer started with no.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of Famous Failures. I'm your host, Ozan Barol. Today's guest on the show is Rob Walker. Rob is an author and journalist covering design, technology, business, the arts, and other subjects. He writes the human resources column for Lifehacker, and he has in the past contributed to the New York Times, Bloomberg, Business Week, The Atlantic, The New Yorker, and many others. He is on the faculty of the Products of Design program at the School of Visual Arts, and his new book, just out today, is called The Art of Noticing, 131 Ways to Spark Creativity, Find Inspiration, and Discover Joy in the Everyday. In the interview, Rob and I discuss how a broken coffee mug, of all things, sent Rob on a creative path to launch the Significant Objects Project, why a meaningless object purchased on average for just $1.50 can sell for $36 on average on eBay if it has a story attached to it, even if the story is fictional. This is one of the things that Rob discovered on the Significant Objects Project. We talk about where Rob's creative ideas come from, how Rob bombed a news interview with Steve Jobs, and why this failure was a blessing in disguise, why we fail to pay attention to the world around us and the dangers associated with the war against seeing, how you can awaken your senses and see the world anew, what three strategies that Rob uses most regularly from his latest book on the art of noticing, and much, much more. As always, if you're enjoying the show, please take a moment to leave a rating on iTunes or Google Play. That goes a long way to alerting other potential listeners to the show. If you'd like to keep in touch with me, your host, you can sign up for my weekly newsletter. The Weekly Contrarian is the name of it. It goes out to nearly 14,000 subscribers each week, and it shares with you an article that I wrote that week, along with recommendations for books, other articles, tools, quotes, really anything that helps challenge conventional wisdom and hopefully helps you see the world a little bit differently. You can sign up for that by heading over to weeklycontrarian.com. Without further ado, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Rob Walker, and thank you, as always, for listening. Rob, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
So I want to go back a little bit to a project you worked on several years ago, the Significant Objects Project. Can you tell us what the project was about and why you decided to start it?
I guess it makes sense to talk about the origin of it. The easiest way to explain this is that I had this coffee cup that I broke, which doesn't sound very interesting, but it was just a sort of a $7 mug from a diner, very commodity level object. But I was really heartbroken about it. The reason being that I had bought this particular coffee mug at a diner in Baltimore where I went on a trip early in my relationship with the woman who later I married. So it had this value to it, but the value was not in the object. It was in the story that was attached to the object. I found that interesting, and I was writing the consumed column at the New York Times Magazine at the time. So I was writing a lot about commodities and value and products and value. And I got really interested in how far we could take this idea of story driving value. So with my frequent collaborator, Joshua Glenn, who is a journalist and a semiotician, we devised this project where we would test it, where we bought, Josh and I bought a bunch of objects, meaningless objects from thrift stores and yard sales and things for $2 to $3, sometimes much less, never more than four. And then we hired, or not hired, but we recruited a bunch of storytellers. And, you know, these were serious people like William Gibson and Nicholson Baker and Meg Cabot. Like, not everybody was quite at that high level, Kurt Anderson, but, you know, some well-known people, literary writers, TV writers, comedians, all kinds of people. We ended up doing more than 100 or 200 stories anyway, but they would invent totally fake stories about each object. And we would use those stories as the product description on eBay. So we would list the meaningless, you know, thrift store doll or whatever it was with a story by Meg Cabot. It wasn't a hoax. It said the significance of this object has been invented by Meg Cabot. we would list it on eBay with the price that we bought it for as the opening bid and then let it run for 2 weeks. And so it was a smashing success. The average price we paid for an object was less than a dollar, and the average sales price was $36. So it proved, and you know, when I say proved, we treated it as if it were a scientific experiment. Of course, it was not really. It was a game. But we were proved right. Every single thing sold for more than we paid for it. And then more significantly, the people who were buying them from us started sending us pictures of, here's the object that where I've put it on my mantle in my house. Some of them took them to readings by Milo Goldberg and people like that who, you know, they would confront the writer with, hey, I bought this object at the significant object thing and get them to sign it. So it was a very fun experiment, and it became a book. It was published by Fantagraphics in maybe 2015, 2014, somewhere around there. But yeah, so that's the significant objects project.
I love this.
Sorry, but that's a little long-winded.
No. That was perfect. And I love the project for so many reasons. Well, one is like, talk about an ROI, a return on investment, going from an average of $1.50 to $36. That's amazing. Yeah. And you know, and you always hear that people are really paying for the story and not the thing they buy. Like, you're not really paying for your gym membership. You're paying for the story that you tell yourself about how you're going to look like, you know, at the end of the summer when you're sitting on the beach. So it's just so cool to see it materialize in a very concrete way on eBay. And it also made me think about why I value my physical books so much. I've tried reading on like a Kindle or an iPad. It never works as well for me. And I think because what I'm seeing on the digital screen lacks a story. So when I buy a physical book, there is a story about the bookstore that I bought the book from. There's a story about the wine stain on page 33. There is a size and a shape and that feel that the story that attaches to the physical book, I think, is missing in the ebook context. And so that reminded me of that too, about why I value physical books so much, and also why I retain them, because it's just there is that physical feeling to it, and then the story that comes along with it, that I think, at least in my case, boosts my retention.
Yeah, I think that's probably legitimate. And I think it's interesting because I think, like a lot of people, I went through a phase of kind of like, okay, electronic books are the future, so I'm going to try that. And I did read books on my iPad for a while, and I just eventually decided I didn't enjoy it as much and went back to physical books. And you kind of see some version of that playing out in the numbers, like the ebooks sales kind of plateaued and I think may have fallen. Yeah, it's easier to have, you know, of course, I have a lot of books that have no story at all,
right?
Stacked up all over the place in here. But yes, there are the books. When I ask people about, or when I talk to people about objects, if you think about the objects you would save from your house if the hurricane was coming or whatever, you know, the impending disaster, books come up a lot in that you know, specific books. I have, in my case, I have a book that was my father's writing textbook, like in college, and where he drew a Bugs Bunny on the back cover. And I like everything about it, and I would hate to lose that. That's my most... Yeah, definitely a valuable object with an object of value. This was what significant objects was about. Value is something that's really personal. Like, we talk about value in marketplace terms all the time. When you really get down to what's most valuable to you, it's what's most valuable to you, which is, that book wouldn't mean, I couldn't sell that on eBay for more than a dime. But to me, it's priceless.
So one of the other reasons why I wanted to ask you about the Significant Objects Project is, one of the takeaways, at least from me, was the power of stories. Once a story is attached to an object, particularly if it's a personal story, the perceived value skyrockets dramatically. And that, to me, says that stories can be really powerful. And I always knew that on an intuitive level. So it was really cool to see some numbers attached to it. But stories can also be used for good and bad. So they can be used to move people and instigate positive change, but they can also be used for malicious ends, particularly in the marketplace. And I wonder if you've given any thought to that. Like, is there anything that people can do to be vigilant against this malicious use of storytelling?
Well, the interesting thing about that, as I say, I used to write the Consume column for the Times Magazine, and I wrote another book called Buying In, which is essentially about sort of deconstructing the language of marketing. One of the funny side effects of the Significant Objects Project was marketers getting in touch with us and saying, hey, that's what we do. We we attach stories to objects, and always sort of interested in that because it's like, you know, our stories are fiction. Is that what you do? Because if we're doing the same thing, you have some explaining to do about what you're doing with your life. I don't know. I mean, you know, the language of marketing and the language of stories, stories are seductive, and people, there's a reason that people communicate through their stories, and stories can obscure or manipulate facts. So yeah, this is way outside of my realm of expertise. So I don't know that I have any particular advice beyond, you know, be vigilant and think twice about everything you hear. But like, I can't give you any better advice than your grandmother could give you on that.
No, I think that is good advice though. Instead of sort of instinctively accepting the story, even just knowing that humans are vulnerable to being moved by stories, I think is really helpful. Because when you do hear a powerful story, instead of just sort of going along with it, pausing for a moment, and this will tie into your new book, The Art of Noticing, but pausing for a moment and contemplating instead of instinctively accepting it is, I think, a really powerful start. We're going to jump all over the place here, but how did you decide to write for a living?
When I was a kid, when I was a teenager, I was a pretty directionless teenager. I said I didn't have a lot of ideas about what to do. I sort of tried everything. I sort of hit on the idea of like fiction writing as something that seemed fun and easy. I had no idea what I was talking about. Basically, I read some Stephen King novels when I was 16 and thought, I'll do this. So I was an idiot. And then I went to college. I stumbled into the idea of journalism, essentially. I was literally trying to figure out, I was standing in a building at the university. I went to the University of Texas, and I was in a building where this magazine was, student magazine was situated, that I was trying to convince to look at my short stories. And there was a flyer on the door that said, we're looking for people to write music reviews two stories down in this same building at the student newspaper. So I went two stories down in that building and ended up starting to write. That was my introduction to writing, was Depeche Mode records and that kind of thing. And that led, so it was a student paper, and the student paper was called the Daily Texan. And it was a very transformative place for me. I met a lot of terrific people. I was introduced to the idea of ambition. I had some natural ability as a writer, so there's just luck. But that was the place that put me on a path toward figuring out, oh, this is a craft that you can get better at and you can aspire to do better things. And so I got more and more ambitious as time went along. And I was very lucky in that, I was 18. So at that, just to figure out at 18 what you want to do is a lucky thing.
It takes many of us, you know, me included, second, third, fourth career to really settle down on what you want to do. So that is really lucky. You did eventually take the leap from being a journalist to writing books, and you've done both at the same time. Can you tell us a little bit about that transition, why you decided to take the leap to being an author as well?
Well, I mean, I don't see it as a leap. I see it as an extension of what of the kind of work I was doing. So I've done a vast variety. I mean, I literally started out with Depeche Mode reviews and that kind of thing. Like, I worked for an alternative weekly doing newsy stuff. And then I moved to New York and I worked for a legal publication. I always had pretty broad range. The first book that I did was a book of essays about New Orleans called Letters from New Orleans. And that was just personal writing. So it wasn't even really like, oh, I'm taking this ambitious leap. It was, I was doing this other writing on the side that I felt was that there wasn't a commercial market for. That was, I guess, the dividing line for me, was between what I could do to get paid and what I could do that I probably wouldn't get paid for, but I really wanted to do. The second book, the Buying In book, the story there is much more traditional. It was just, I was in my 30s and it was sort of professional matter. It was time to write a book.
Right.
I was doing the Consumed column, which was consumer culture stuff. The book was in the realm of consumer culture. That was my beat. That was my brand at the time. And so that's what I did. So it's not that. And the Significant Objects comes more in the realm of having a side project. And the Art of Noticing book is somewhere in between. But I guess we'll get to that.
So you describe the book writing as a natural extension of journalism. Do you find that your writing process is different versus, on the one hand, writing a column versus writing a book?
I did a lot of long form journalism at one time. So that's a certain kind of process. I've also gone through phases where I worked for Yahoo News for a while and did very fast turnaround, you know, off the news technology related stuff. So there are different registers. And I guess that I don't know. I mean, this is interesting. It's getting more introspective than I was anticipating here. But on the one hand, I just do the same thing. I just write. That's really all I do, an edit with the significant objects and other projects like that. It's kind of all the same thing. On the other hand, there are all these different registers, and I like doing new things within this realm. So after the consumed column ended, I got the chance to do an advice column for the Times and for the business section that was workplace advice. And one of the reasons that I said I would do it, because it's kind of like a Dear Abby for the workplace.
Sure.
And I don't do it for them anymore, but it's Human Resources, the column now for lifehacker.com. One of the reasons I was interested in doing that is because I had been, you know, at that point I'd been a writer for 20 years and I'd never worked in that form. And that form really interested me. And I didn't. So there was this period where I was going through a lot of experimentation, doing oral history work for a little while, just anything different. I think it's a pretty standard story. You do one kind of work for a long time. You want to try other kinds of work.
And we did get a little glimpse of where you get your ideas from when you talked about how you were motivated to start the Significant Objects Project after you saw this broken coffee mug that had a story attached to it. What other sources do you find ideas from? And the reason I'm asking this is, I mean, you've written about so many diverse subjects, everything from marketing to consumer culture to workplace advice, and now a book on noticing. Where do the ideas come from, or the inspiration?
All I can say is ideas are sort of an offshoot of curiosity, and curiosity is not a set of tasks. It's a mindset. It's a way of being in the world. I remember when I was pretty young, an editor giving me the advice, like, what do you do when your boss tells you to find a story? Like, go find a story. Like, what do? Read the paper, you know? Like, so you have to make it part of your practice to like have conversations with strangers, be observant, be attuned to the world. This will relate directly to the art of noticing, which is believe in the idea that the things you notice that no one else is talking about still may have value. Because I think that there's this tendency that people have to say, like, well, if I notice it, but no one else is talking about it, it must not be very important. If it was important, everybody would be talking about it already. Well, for a journalist, the whole point is to not necessarily even be first, but to just be to be zoned in on something that breaks you away from the pack. Like, that's the whole point. One famous journalistic example is Jimmy Breslin. You know, you're familiar with Jimmy Breslin? He's sort of a legendary journalist, columnist guy.
Sure. Yep. I've heard the name.
So after JFK was assassinated, everybody was doing the story of the day of the funeral.
Right.
So he was the one person who came up with his version of that story, was that he spent the day beforehand with the guy who dug the grave.
Oh.
It's a way of finding the different way in that breaks you from the pack. You're thinking about the thing that no one else is thinking about. And that's the whole game. There's no trick to that. It's just curiosity, open-mindedness, and confidence, basically. Confidence that if I think this is going to be interesting, I can make it interesting. I can explain to other people why it's interesting.
That's amazing. I'll now have to go back and dig up the story about the guy.
It's very easy to find that, actually. You can Google that. And it's a very famous story. It's used in a lot of textbooks and things. It's literally a textbook example of what a journalist is supposed to do.
For those listening, we'll link to that article in the show notes as well. So before we transition to talking about your last book, I want to ask you about your failures. So if you look back on your career, what stands out as one of the most valuable failures that you've had, and what makes it valuable?
Yeah, I mean, I've had so many failures, it's very difficult to choose. I suppose that one that I talk about or think about a lot was a moment when I was actually when I was pretty young, I was maybe 24, and I was very frustrated with journalism because of I was just trying to find my way and I wasn't sure that it was working out. I had moved to New York and things were hard. I interviewed for a job at the ACLU, which I would have been a publicist for the ACLU, which I was politically, I'm very in line with the ACLU, and it was specifically devoted to this sort of arts related project that they had at the time. I was really set up for this, and I went in and they asked me, this was during the era of the Mapplethorpe and Serrano, these very controversial art exhibits that were going on that were those fighting over censorship. The first interview question was something like, why is it important for these controversial artworks to be seen? Which is a pretty core question. Like, that's the yeah. most obvious question. And I just had drew a total blank. I had nothing. I had no answer. I just fumbled around. I'll never forget it. So there was that. That was a big failure. And what did I learn from it? I mean, I think that what I learned from it was that I'm an observer. I'm better at being the observer. I'm not good at being the one who's making I'm not cut out to be in representing the ACLU. It wasn't a natural role for me. I had a story in the Times magazine. It was about 2 years after the iPod had come on the market. And this was not my story idea, but I was asked to do a story for them about the iPod, for their a design issue, about the design of this object, which at the time was 2 years after launch. Like, it was clear the iPod had become this game-changing thing. And so as part of that, I was going to get to interview Steve Jobs. And I was all excited, obviously, like, wow, this guy's, you know, he's one of the true geniuses and everything. And, you know, you're kind of daydreaming, like, maybe we'll really hit it off and whatever. And I'll get his card, you know, I'll be able to follow up with him and get exclusive access to things later or whatever. But no, the interview was a complete meltdown. Like, every single question I asked, his answer started with no. And I was sweating. And I remember going into the parking lot afterwards and like calling my wife. And I was just like, it's a disaster. I don't know what I'm going to do. But then, you know, I went over the tape and I realized that even though it was catastrophic on one level, on another level, it was revealing. And there was actually really good material in it. And in some ways, that interview and the fact that it was contentious made the story. So I learned from that this thing that feels like being kicked in the face, which is exactly how it felt, like it had just gone so wrong, can, if you get a little distance on it, still have value in it. And you just have to sort of learn to look at it from a slightly different angle, because it truly made the story. And I'll send you the link to that. You can put that in your show notes.
Yeah, please do. I love that story, especially since that's actually something that Steve Jobs himself talks about in that famous Stanford commencement speech, where he says, you know, life connects the dots for you. Something that feels like a failure in the moment can actually be a blessing in hindsight. And I think at the time he was referring to his getting fired from Apple. So it's interesting that the same lesson applies in your case.
A little smaller scale in my
case.
Yeah,
but to the interview with Steve Jobs himself. So
yeah.
Great story. Well, thank you for sharing that. Let's talk about your book, your last book, that is, The Art of Noticing, 131 Ways to Spark Creativity, Find Inspiration, and Discover Joy in the Everyday. I'm going to start with perhaps a somewhat obvious question, but I think it's an important one to ask. Why is it important to pay attention to the world? You already gave us a glimpse of this a little bit with your answer to the curiosity mindset when you talked about the journalists who wrote about the guy who dug the grave when everybody else was sort of chasing the obvious lead. But we can begin there, or you can take this in whatever direction you'd like. Why is it important to pay attention?
So there's two levels to this. One is the sort of eternal level, and the second is the sort of contemporary level. And I'll start with the contemporary one, which is that, and we don't probably have to spend too much time on this, that, you know, I think maybe you're familiar and your listeners may be familiar with the idea that people feel like their attention is kind of under assault right now.
Right.
We kind of live in an era of distraction. There's kind of a lot of people trying to get in your face and get in your timeline or whatever it is, you know, your notifications. So everyone, I think, feels that. And I went through this phase where I thought that I was going to write a book that was about that. And it would have been 290 pages of diagnosing this problem, and then 10 pages of here's some useful, fun things you can do to respond to this problem. Eventually, I realized I didn't want to read, let alone write, the 290 pages of the problem. I just was interested in those last 10 pages, and like, that's the book. So that's what this book is the here are things you can do to engage with the world and reawaken that sense of, you know, connection with the everyday. And that was in line with the second level of this, what I see as an eternal issue, why is it important to pay attention? Why is it important to notice? And why is it important to note things that everyone else missed? Which is because I think that that's really at the essence of creativity, starts with noticing something. Progress, innovation starts with noticing something that other people missed.
Right.
That's the beginning. That's the ultimate competitive advantage, is noticing something that other people missed. Whether you're Warren Buffett, Warren Buffett's entire investment strategy is based on tuning out what the crowd is doing, right?
Right.
Whether you're Billy Beane, the baseball executive who sort of figured out if we zone in on this data that everyone else is ignoring, there might be some advantage to that. Many artists, there's a lot of stuff derived from the arts in the book. Artists are particularly good at sort of noticing what other people have missed and engaging with the world in a sort of more genuine, authentic way. And, going along with this zeitgeist thing of people worrying about the attention economy and all that is this parallel thing of an interest in mindfulness and meditation. And there's no coincidence there. Those things are directly related. People are trying to figure out how to negotiate this technological/cultural moment that we're in and maintain some sense of connection to real life.
Right. And if I can add one more to that list, it goes back to something we were talking about before, but the spread of misinformation, either stories or other means, I think combating nonstop distraction is one way of stemming the tide of misinformation. There's a quote by Chuck Palahniuk, the author of Fight Club, that came to mind. I actually just pulled it up, but he says, "Old George Orwell got it backward. Big Brother isn't watching. He's singing and dancing. He's pulling rabbits out of a hat. Big Brother is busy holding your attention every moment you're awake. He's making sure you're always distracted. He's making sure you're fully absorbed. He's making sure your imagination withers until it's as useful as your appendix. He's making sure your attention is always filled, and this being fed is worse than being watched. With the world always filling you, no one has to worry about what's in your mind. With everyone's imagination atrophied, no one will ever be a threat to the world."
Mm-hmm.
And I think that connects nicely to the premise of the book as well. And perhaps not an obvious takeaway, but it was one for me when I picked up your book, was, this is one way of being more mindful about what's being thrown at us and exercising the muscles to not be distracted by everything we're hearing in the news or everything that might be popping up in our social media feed.
Sure, I would agree with that. I mean, the way I would spin that maybe is, I definitely think that there is a curious, not among everybody, but among enough people, that there is a curious overvaluing of now information, like what's happening, like right now, this second, like being like, you don't want to get left behind. You want to be in on the trending topic. And that bleeds directly into, I mean, how often have you had the experience of like your friend who's always the first to know, like X% of the thing they're first to know is totally wrong.
Right.
So like, how exciting is it to be and then they're the first to know that it's wrong. Like they're like, oh, it's been debunked. And it's like, oh, well, I'm ahead of the game because I didn't even hear the false. But so all of that, I totally agree with. And I think that's a real thing. What I'm trying to, I guess, add to that discussion is, I think that a lot of the responses to that phenomenon are framed in a sort of denial based way of like, let's deny ourselves, like you need to digital detox, you need to shut your phone off, which is all fine. I'm trying to sort of say, well, look, I think that there's just some intrinsic value in spending, let's just say, an hour a week devoting yourself to controlling your attention and paying attention to what you want to pay attention to and just reveling in noticing the world and engaging with the world and what it looks like, what it sounds like, what it smells like, or whatever. I'm kind of trying to just put a positive, here's something you can do, as opposed to here's something you have to stop doing.
And as I was mentioning to you before we started recording here, I already began implementing some of the strategies in the book. And it's, one favorite of mine that I now have been doing every day since I got the book is to notice something new every day.
Yeah.
So my wife and I walk our dog in the morning, and it's been so much fun just, on that 15-minute walk, paying more attention to the world and trying to see something that I had previously missed. It's been awesome.
That's a perfect example. And I use that, the dog walk example, because nothing makes me sadder than people who I see someone walking their dog and they're sort of scrolling on their phone.
Right.
And it's just like, what a lost opportunity. Like, be in the world, be with your dog.
Yeah.
No, but the dog walk is a great one also because it's a routine, right? Like, you're probably walking over roughly the same territory over and over again.
Right,
it's very
exactly.
easy to get into a rut, very easy to stop seeing, stop engaging with what's going on around you. That's the perfect opportunity is to challenge yourself to say, like, okay, we're going to notice something new because something has changed since yesterday. And believe me, your dog knows.
Yeah. I was just going to mention that too. I mean, it's as easy as just following where your dog is going because they're just, you know, they pay so much attention to the world.
For them, it's a big deal. They don't have Twitter.
Exactly. So out of the 131 ways, and I love, by the way, one of the things I love about the book is that you actually rank order things in degree of difficulty from 1 to 4, which is great. So like for those who want sort of a low threshold way of entering this world, you can start with the easy ones as opposed to the advanced ones. But out of the 131 ways you cover in the book, and maybe this is like asking for your favorite child or something, but please indulge me. Can you pick 1, 2, I would say maybe 3 favorite ones or ones that you use more regularly yourself than the other ones?
The very first one in the book is the first one for a reason. It's this, why I call it the personal scavenger hunt or something along those lines, where because it's a very good like entry level, what do you call it? A gateway drug. It's a gateway drug instance of making noticing something that's fun and easy to make part of your life. And it is... In short, it's to look for one thing that repeats through the environment. And the example, how this came about is I was taking a trip to San Francisco, a city that I had visited a number of times. So I was kind of like, I was past the phase of being like, oh my God, beautiful San Francisco. I mean, it is beautiful, but you know, I was going to be doing a lot of work. So I was going to be running around. I didn't have time to do any, I wasn't going to get to like do any real sightseeing. So I wanted to give myself some way of engaging with the city in a new way. And so my one parameter was I want to look for one thing that no one wants me to look for. No one wants me to notice. So the thing I picked was security cameras. Everywhere I went, I was looking for security cameras. And, you know, first of all, you kind of learn something about like, wow, there's a lot of security cameras and they're treated in different ways. And they
talk
have
about
aesthetics.
Big Brother.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's a little unnerving. But also like literally looking up a lot changes your perspective on the city, you know, so you notice other things that aren't related to that. I didn't have any point to this. It was just an adventure. And then I always have to mention that I got to the airport after I told my wife I was doing this. And I got to the airport when I was leaving town. I was like, okay, the plane's on time. And she knew I was taking pictures of security cameras. And I said, by the way, the security camera situation at the airport is totally bananas. It's just like so many cameras. Like, they look amazing. And she said, Rob, please do not walk around the San Francisco airport taking pictures of the security.
The TSA might have a word or two to say about that.
Yeah, no. So she's probably saved me from – I'd be in Guantanamo now, I guess. Anyway, so – but like versions of that I've done various places. And just – you know, you could just look – you could just pick a thing like, you know, mailboxes or neighborhood watch signs or no loitering – like any sort of thing that – just some random thing. But I like the parameter that I think is important there is to look for something that no one is trying to get you to look at. You know what I mean? Like it's not – being advertised, there's no clever campaign pushing you in the direction of, and it just gives you a different thing. So that's one. The other one that I do all the time myself is the book starts with more visually oriented things and then tries to move into other senses. And so this one is about listening, and I call it Cover 433. And that's a reference to a John Cage composition, which was a guy sitting in front of a piano not playing it for 4 minutes and 33 seconds. So it's just silence. And the first time this was an avant-garde thing, and the first time it was performed, it did not go over well. But what it amounts to is just like this arbitrary amount of time. And Cage was trying to make a point about what's the border between music and silence. How I translate it is when I say cover it like a cover band, every once in a while, your office, your home, whatever, set your phone to 4 minutes and 33 seconds and just sit there and listen. It's really focusing, relaxing. In my case, I do it repeatedly in my home office. So I've learned the sounds of my neighborhood in a totally different way. And it's only 4 minutes and 33 seconds. It's kind of like meditation, except you can't do it wrong. You know how people meditating, like, it's always, there's no way to do this wrong. So I like that one. That's, and you asked for three, so I'll give you one more. Very easy. Look out a window, which sounds almost like insulting advice, but seriously think about a window that you walk past in your home, your office, or whatever all the time, and you don't ever look out it. Spend 5 minutes like really looking through that window and look to like bend around, look at the edges of everything you can see, and then do it again in a week and see what's changed. You know, think about what kind of nature you're seeing, what kind of architecture you're seeing, what kind of people you're seeing. I don't know what your window looks like. It's another good gateway to just sort of start to get you in the mindset. And as you say, they get, those are all pretty easy ones. They get more complicated and challenging.
But yeah, but that's a great place for our listeners to start. And by the time this interview is out, the book will be available for purchase wherever books are sold. Rob, thank you so much for joining us. We've come to the end of our time here. If people want to find you online, where should they look?
The number one thing to do, I would say, is robwalker.net/noticing. Has stuff about the book and what's going on with the book and events and things like that. We have an event, I think, that will be happening the May 7th in New York. If anybody happens to hear this, like the minute that it comes out, you can check robwalker.net/noticing and get the details on that. But also there's a newsletter. I started the newsletter a couple months ago and basically offering ideas like this once every week or two that didn't fit in the book or that I thought of since the book came out. So that's a good place. If you like Twitter, I'm on Twitter at @notrobwalker. Those are the best places.
Excellent. Well, Rob, thank you so much for joining us. This was so much fun.
Thanks so much. It was a real pleasure. I enjoyed talking to you.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. Two things before you take off. First, if you don't want to miss out on future episodes of Famous Failures, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on, and be sure to leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. Second, if you'd like to join thousands of others who receive a short email from me each Thursday with a list of articles, books, tools, quotes, and other gems that help you discover how extraordinary thinking produces extraordinary results, you can text my first name, which is Ozan, that's spelled O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. So once again, that's my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. Or if you're in front of your computer, you can head over to ozanvarol.com and drop your email address. If you act now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles to Innovate Your Thinking. As always, thank you for listening and see you next time.